Hello and good morning to Studies Through the Bible with Pastor Zach Ebar. I am Pastor Zach, and today we are going to continue looking at our studies in Genesis. I do apologize to everybody in case we had any problems or issues or anything like that. From our podcast not being able to go live Friday, we had some internet problems throughout the weekend. And so today we're going to catch up with where we were supposed to be last week. And then this coming Friday, we will be doing things as normally scheduled, 10 o'clock my time, which is Central Eastern time for those of you that may be a little further out or further away from where we are. But we will have this one this week, and we will have our regularly scheduled one this Friday so that we can stay on track with where we are supposed to be. But to kind of give you a little bit of a refresher in case you're new or you're showing up today and you don't know where we are, these kinds of things. Or you're listening to the recording later and you're wanting to getting started, looking at the most recent one, this kind of thing. We have been going through the book of Genesis, obviously, systematically, through every single chapter. And we have worked on and have gone through, the first 12 chapters of Genesis. Today we're on chapter 12. And for those of you that have been listening and keeping up and all of these things, we have, from chapter 11, seen, of course, the Tower of Babel. And then we are introduced to our guy, Abram, who many of you, if you've been in church for a while or you are just recently come in, you probably know the name Abraham, the same guy. Abraham, of course, is his covenant name. Abram is his regular name, the name that he had when he first began to form his relationship with God, and God called him to go to the land that he would show him. And just to kind of give you a little bit of refresher from last week, we had an introduction to Abram. And I told you guys that we were going to talk about Abraham a little bit more specifically today than what we have been in the last couple of days. But to give you a little refresher, going back up to chapter 11, it said, now these are the generations of Terah, Terah being Abram's father. He begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran, and Haran begat Lot, and Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his nativity in Ur of the Chaldees. And Abram and Nahor took them wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, and the father of Iscah. But Sarai was barren. She had no child. And Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his son's son, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth with them from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan. And they came unto Haran and dwelt there. And the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. So, looking last week at chapter 11, we of course saw on the Tower of Babel, we saw God confound the languages, we talked about the creations of cultures and the spreading of man all over the world, how all of that would have looked, what all would have happened, and of course we tied that in with chapter 11, or chapter 10 and 9. As I told you guys, as we're moving through Genesis, we're going to be backtracking and tying, building on all of these ideas and how they fell, just due to the nature of how the whole book is written and how Hebrew culture expresses itself and states the things that it's stating. They keep their one point, and then they may need to backtrack to get to their next point as we start to tie all this together. And today we're going to run into that a little bit. Okay, when we get into chapter 12 this morning, we're going to see the call of Abram for the first time in the Bible. But this is not entirely true. And what I'm saying is not that the Word of God isn't true, but that the way that this appears is not entirely true. I told all of you last week, and if you read ahead, I hope you read ahead, you're probably going, where in the world is this guy getting that Abram was called out of Ur, and he took his father and his nephew and his family, and they went to Haran, and then he hung out there for 7 years until his dad died, and then he turned around and he came back this way. You know, where did he get that at? Because what I see is that they went to Haran, Terah is dead, and now Abram and Lot leave Haran, and they go and they listen to the call of God. Well, we get that from the message that Stephen preached in Acts chapter 7, verses 2 through 4. We see that Abram was called while he was in Mesopotamia before he dwelt in Haran. So what we're seeing today in Genesis chapter 12 is a repeating of God's promise to Abram. So with that in mind, let's get started here in chapter 12 and start kind of getting these pictures all painted together. It says, "Now the Lord said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto a land that I will shew thee, and I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee. And in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed." So to give you a full picture of what happens here is we have Abram, a Gentile man, by technicality. He's from Ur of the Chaldees, which is a Mesopotamian country, or Mesopotamian city, I should say. And then, of course, Haran, which is a little bit northwestern direction from Ur of the Chaldees, which is also still in Mesopotamia. He is called while he's in Ur of the Chaldees, and God tells him, get thee out of thy country and away from thy kindred, meaning your whole family, from your father's house, reiterating this idea again. You need to leave your family, leave all of them behind, and you need to go to a place that I'm going to show you. Many of you, if you've been raised in church or you've been around church for a little bit of time, and maybe depending on what your pastor or your preacher is going through at your particular church, you may be a little bit more refreshed on this. But Abraham has always been painted as a man of great faith. For example, I have a young daughter, and we try to find things on TV every now and again. She doesn't get to sit in front of it all day, maybe once or maybe 30 minutes at the most a day. Something maybe to kind of, if she's being too crazy in my office while I'm studying and things, I may use a little bit to keep her in a prone position and immobile position, kind of have something for her to glue her eyes on for a few minutes, give me a moment to take care of something that I may need to take care of. And one of the things that she gets to watch is VeggieTales, the old VeggieTales from back in my day and my wife's day, and for many of you, probably beyond our days. And one of the ones that she watched that I happened to come in on the beginning of is the story about Abraham. And through that whole thing, they paint Abraham as a man that had always had great faith. And that is not at all true. Abraham has a very, very rocky start. It is not until the latter part of his life that Abraham finally reaches a place of having great faith in God. He just didn't have it. His relationship with God was very young. He was a man that, in a lot of ways, was a coward at the very beginning of his life. So while we're looking at this, I don't want you to try to put these men on a pedestal, okay? That's one of the biggest dangers that we have with studying the Bible is we get these ideas of grandeur about men like Abraham and David and Solomon and Daniel and all these different ones that we kind of, Paul in the New Testament or Apollos and these kinds of guys. We tend to place these men in a position of they're untouchable, their decisions are unquestionable, and that's not true. With the Bible, the whole point of what God gives you about all of these people is to show you that while these men had great qualities about them, David was a man after God's own heart. You can't refute that. But David also was a man. Abraham ends up being a great man of faith, but Abraham was also a man. When we're studying the Bible, we have to keep these men on an even keel. if we raise them up too high, they're going to fall greatly when you actually sit down and read the Bible and go, oh my goodness, they did that, and they did that, they did that, they did that. But at the same time, we don't want to take away what God acknowledges about these men later on in their lives as well. So looking at this right off the bat, we see this call of Abram, but we know from Acts chapter 7 that this call had already been made, and Abram partially was obedient. He went to Haran with his daddy, and he stayed there until his daddy died. After his daddy died, God comes to him again. He's like, okay, Abram, we tried to do this a couple years before, and you didn't quite get it. So we're going to try this again. Get out of your country. Leave Mesopotamia, away from your family. Leave everything behind that is a part of your family. And I will show you a land that you can go to. I will give you a land. And when you get there, I will make a great nation of you, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. So right off the bat, God is giving a beautifully amazing promise to this man. If you will go where I want you to go, your family will become a mighty nation. That's what the idea is, great, meaning strong, powerful, mighty nation. Not in size, because we know Israel is one of the smaller countries in the world, but that they would be of a powerhouse. They would be a strong people. I will bless you, meaning that I will take care of you, watch over you. And as we know, Abraham became a very wealthy man and a very established man. Not saying today, this morning, that if you do what you're supposed to do, God's going to rain millions of dollars down on your head. That's not true. This concept of I will bless thee means that if you will go and do what I want you to do, you will be taken care of. All of these things will be met for you. I will make your name great, meaning that it would be well known. Some here say honored. That's kind of correct. I'd be very careful with that. The only reason that I'd be careful with that is because if we're going to give honor and glory to a man, we're missing the whole point of the Bible. God's supposed to get all the glory, not men. I would say great as in he is well known and he is well respected. We all know that if it were not for Abraham getting his act together, then is, you know, and doing what God had told him to do, eventually we would have been without the Jewish nation as we know it in the Bible, as we know it today. So in making your name great mean that you'd be exalted, that you would have a standing, you'd be very well known. And even today, in various religious groups, even with Christians, Muslims, and Jews, the name Abraham is of an importance because we all kind of agree on the Old Testament for the most part. It's when we start getting into the what do we do with Jesus conversation that we all have our problem, okay? And so God tells him, I'm going to make a great nation out of you. I'm going to bless you. I'm going to raise your name, meaning you're going to be well known. You're going to be respected, honored, however you want to put that. And then he says, and you shall be a blessing. So it's not just you're going to be a great nation. I'm going to bless you. I'm going to make your name great, but also that you as an individual, you as a person, will be a blessing to others. And that is really painted and shown for us in verse 3, because he says, and I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee. And in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. When we get into this discussion of I will bless those that bless you and curse those that curse you, people tend to forget why God does that. And one of the biggest things you get is people will always go in on the United States. Well, that's why the Lord watches over us and he loves us, is because we pay attention to Israel. And that's not wrong. The fact that we are paying attention to Israel, that we recognize Israel, that we have good relations with Israel, does indeed keep us in the position that we are in. If you look at when the Greeks raided Israel, they were very quickly taken over by the Romans. When the Romans raided Israel and started killing people and desecrating the temple, they were very quickly brought down and destroyed. when you see the Spanish Inquisition, where they were trying to kill many Jewish people, Spain never became anything like it was after that. They fell into the ground. They were no longer a great empire anymore. If you look at Austrian Germany under Hitler with the pogroms and the mass killing and genocide of the Jewish people, they have never recovered from that. They are not a very well-over country. They have suffered a lot of defeat, Austria more than Germany. And we could go on and on and on with countries that when they turned and went after Israel and attempted to harm Israel, that they were brought to their knees. If the United States was to ever turn its back on Israel, I don't have any doubt in my mind that we would be in the same boat. But there is one thing about this verse that everybody leaves out. They do the, I'll bless them that bless thee and curse them that curse thee. See, we're supposed to be nice to Israel. That's true. But this is why. And in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. Guys, this wasn't something of, oh, they have a special hedge around them. Nobody can be mean to them. Nobody can bully them. Nobody can pick on them. The whole purpose for this was through you, the Messiah is going to come. You are going to be a blessing to the world. And because you're going to be a blessing to the world, I'm going to do these things for you. Israel, by nature, was supposed to be missionary. They were supposed to be of a people that went and spread the truth and told people about God and were an example to the world of who godly people are and what they're supposed to be doing. They were supposed to be an ambassador for God as a nation to the rest of the world. This was not intended for the way it's being used today of, oh, they have a special protection. They have a special protection because they had a job they were supposed to be doing. But instead, we see in Israel's history that they completely blow it. God continues to honor this promise to this day. It has no conditions. It is a covenant with Abraham that does not lay out, but if you act a fool, this goes away. But the biggest problem that we have is that we only half-truth this verse. We just go, oh, well, no, you're not supposed to be mean to them. Why? God did not just give them some sort of special privilege because they were just great, awesome people. God gave them this privilege and this protection because they were supposed to be carrying the truth throughout the world. God shows Abraham twice, I will make you a blessing. I will make your nation and your family a blessing to all the families of the world. I'm doing this, Abraham. I'm doing this, Abram. I'm telling you about this place. I'm taking you here. I'm establishing a nation with you, not because of how great you are, but because of the great things I'm going to do with you. Friends, I'm here to tell you today, I'm going to preach at you a little bit. I know we're studying through the Bible, but I'm going to preach at you just a little bit. Anything God does with you has nothing to do with you. It has nothing to do with how great you are. It has nothing to do with how special you may think you are. It has everything to do with what great things God can do with you. Abram wasn't given this promise and this call because he was some great dude right out the door. Abram was given this promise and this call because God knew Abram would eventually get his act together. And that the only way redemption could come into the world was through the plan God was going to set in motion in Abram. We've already seen Abram completely mess up. We know from Acts chapter 7, he was called way before Haran. And this is a repetition of that same call again of God going, okay, your dad's dead now. Are you ready to serve me? You're delaying the promise. You're delaying your own blessing. You're delaying your own opportunity to serve. This is what I'm going to give you, but you got to get your act together and get moving. Now, for many of us, I would hope that if we got called to something by God once and we delayed the blessing of being able to be used for God, that we would kind of get our head on straight and go, okay, all right, God, I'm sorry. I had that little moment there of weakness. I messed up, I flubbed up, whatever. I am now prepared to do what you want me to do. But look at what happens. It says, so Abram departed as the Lord had spoken unto him. You're like, okay, yeah, Brother Zach, this is perfect. This is great. He's leaving just like God told him to. And Lot went with him. What was that second part of that? Get thee out of thy country. Okay, we're leaving. And from thy kindred. Oh, we brought Lot. Even after being called a second time to the same promise years later, Abram still doesn't have the faith, still doesn't have the courage, or still doesn't have the strength, maybe, to walk away from his family and to serve God complete obedience. He says, okay, God, well, I tell you what, this time I'll actually go to the land, but I'm taking Lot with me. And not only does he do this, but it says, and Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. And Abram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their substance that they had gathered, and the souls that they had gotten in Haran. And they went forth to go into the land of Canaan, and into the land of Canaan they came. From thy kindred and from thy what? Father's house. They stop in Haran with his father to let him finish out his days. And while they're there, they amass more and more wealth and more people to their father's house. And Abram, instead of leaving his family and leaving the wealth and the things and the possessions of his father, he gathers up all of it and takes it with him. The only part of God's call to him, of what God tells him to do, that Abram listens to, is leaving Mesopotamia and going there. But he makes sure to take his family, and he makes sure to take his stuff. Abram is not the man of faith that we're going to see Abraham be towards the latter years of his life. Right now, Abram is probably a lot like just the rest of us, where we're like, okay, God, I know you want me to do this, and I will do this piece of what you want me to do. Abram, for a second time, shows partial obedience and no faith to God whatsoever. And it is going to cause him nothing but problems. Taking Lot is going to cause him nothing but problems. Taking the wealth and the things of his father's house and these Gentile peoples with him is going to cause him nothing but problems, because we talked about last week that if he is from Ur of the Chaldees in Mesopotamia, what were the people doing in those places? They were worshiping idols. We see that Abraham's family is still involved in idol worship when we get into even in the days of Isaac and Jacob, where they send Jacob up there to stay with Laban, and Laban has all kinds of idolatry. That is part of Abraham's extended family. So these people are completely swamped in idolatry as well. And he is taking that with him. He's taking these people with him that are wrapped up into this. He only has enough faith to follow one part of what God has told him to do. It says, and Abraham passed through the land unto the place of Shechem, or Shechem. Okay? You also see Sychar in New Testament. It's all the same place. Unto the plain of Moreh. And the Canaanite was then in the land. And the Lord appeared unto Abraham and said, unto thy seed will I give this land. And there builded he an altar unto the Lord who appeared unto him. And he removed from thence into a mountain on the east of Bethel, and pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west and Hai on the east. And there he builded an altar unto the Lord, and called upon the name of the Lord. And Abram journeyed going on still toward the south. So we just partially follow God. We gather up all our stuff. We gather up all our peoples. We gather up our family members, and we go into Canaan. And when we get into Canaan, that we go to a place that becomes extremely, extremely famous, really. It's a place where a lot of very big things happen, and that is Shechem, specifically by the terebinth tree of Moreh. Moreh was known because it kind of had a sizable, notable, however you want to put it, oak tree. Okay, it's a pretty big tree that helped to mark where this particular area was at. But what's interesting is that this is the first time we see Shechem. And Shechem becomes a place where a ton of major events happen. The name means shoulder. And more than likely, that comes from the fact that it's between the hill of Gerizim and Ebal. And they look like shoulders. So you have one big hill, a valley, and one big hill, kind of like on your own back. You have this shoulder that kind of goes up, and then, you know, you kind of have a valley where your neck sits, okay? And so that's more than likely where the name comes from. But what makes this a place of a lot of fame, a lot of rapport, is that we see Jacob came there safely when he comes back with his wives and children. That's Genesis 33. We know that Jacob buys a piece of land from a Canaanite named Hamor here for 100 pieces of silver. Also in Genesis chapter 33, it's 18 and 19. We know that this is also where Jacob built an altar to the Lord and called it El Elohe Israel. And this is also what became known as Jacob's Well. There, we had all of that that happens here. Shechem is also where Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, was raped and his sons massacred the men of the city. That was the having them circumcised, and then they were in so much pain the next day, they just go out and kill all of them. That kind of a twisted story. And then this is also where Jacob bought a plot of ground to give to his son Joseph. And he had conquered this from the Amorites with in war in an unrecorded battle. We see that in Genesis 48. We don't know exactly what happened or what sparked it. There was just a battle, and we know that he claimed that from the Amorites. This is also where Joseph wanted to have his bones buried and was eventually buried when they came back from Egypt. And we also know this is where Joshua gave his very famous, "As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord" sermon. Trying to get Israel to redo their commitment. And then this, amazingly enough, I told you, in the New Testament is known as Sychar. This is where Jesus also met the Samaritan woman at the well in John chapter 4. So Shechem plays as a geographical location, plays a major role in the history of Israel. And this is the first place that we see it. Abram comes into here, and he's in the middle, essentially, of Canaan at Shechem, where all of these things are going to take place at this time called Shechem, as you see in Genesis, but it eventually adopts that H and it becomes Shechem. I've heard some say Shechem. You can say whichever you want. I do not care. Okay? Pronunciation does not matter. If you know the place and you can relatively say the name, it doesn't matter. Tomato, tomato, potato, potato. Okay? And so he comes here, and it tells you that, and at this time, the Canaanite was in the land, meaning that the Canaanite peoples had already taken over. They were a bloodthirsty group of different tribes, even in this day and time. And there was not going to be this situation where Abraham comes in and says, "God gave me this," and they go, "Oh, goodness gracious, let us leave." That is what the idea is that he comes in, and they're in the land. It's theirs. They're not going to share. But what's great about this is I can only think that, you know, Abraham comes in. He sees these wicked, evil tribes that are known for fighting and killing and even fighting amongst themselves. And God comes to him and says, "Unto thy seed will I give this land." Meaning, Abraham, you're here. Chill out. This is what you're supposed to be doing. And my time, things will go the way they're supposed to. Until then, this is going to be yours. Stay here. He doesn't come to him and go, "So you only half followed what I told you to. Told you to leave old Lot at home and to leave all that stuff there too. But instead, God has an extreme amount of patience with Abraham. Doesn't scold him, doesn't get on to him, comes to him and says, look, let's just stay here. Things may look bad. Things may seem bad. This may not be what you thought I was going to give you. This may not be all you think it's cracked up to be, but just stay here. This is where you're supposed to be. I will take care of the rest. And Abraham builds an altar to God, and he worships God, and he pitches his tent in that direction. But there's a problem. It says, and Abram journeyed, going on still toward the south. Even though Abram is showing this faith, he's beginning to kind of weasel his way down south of the border. He's slowly kind of working his way down there like, okay, you know, yeah, God led us here. We're going to stay here. But then he's still kind of slowly inching his way down. Like, well, maybe the land gets better if I kind of creep down south slow and steady. Maybe I'll find a spot that's a little bit more, from a fleshly standpoint, appealing and logical to stay at. And God tests Abraham's faith. It says, and there was a famine in the land. So not only do we have these Canaanite tribes that we need to be concerned about, but then God also allows a famine to come on Canaan. And Abram went down into Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was grievous in the land. Now, we're going to have a very blunt discussion very quickly, okay? Because many people get to this and they go, well, there was a famine in the land. Abram, he had to feed his family and take care of them. They were going to starve and die. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So it makes sense that he would go to Egypt. I mean, it even says the famine was grievous in the land. Why in the world would God have taken him there if all there was going to be when he got there was a famine that was so bad people were dying from it? This brings into a discussion that has become very popular in today's society called biblical situational ethics, which is a very fancy way of saying that sometimes in life there is a gray area between wrong and right. That is not true. If God called Abram to that place and told Abram these promises, Abram, if he had any faith, any belief in God whatsoever, should have known that he was essentially indestructible. God says, I'm going to make a great nation out of you, but the man doesn't even have children. If God promises, I'm going to make a great nation out of you, which means you have to at least have a kid, he isn't going anywhere until he at least has what? A kid, okay? Guys, there's no such thing as situational ethics with the Word of God. There is wrong and there is right. There is no in-between. There's no place where even this discussion that I'm hearing of late of, well, God is love. Yes, you are correct. God is love. Go read 1 Corinthians chapter 13 because it says, love loveth not, cherisheth not, vaunteth not, goes after not, iniquity. Love seeks to do what is right. Love in no way, shape, or form compromises or allows for sin or bad behavior or wrongdoing, however you want to put it, in the life of an individual. You are not showing the love of God by tolerating sin. You show the love of God by addressing sin and telling them how it is that it can be fixed. About the God who can fix it. About the God who can forgive it. About the God who can take it away. What Abram does here is he continues to show he has absolutely no faith in God. God tells him, stay here. I'm going to give this to your children. Stay here. Stay here. He comes to him and assures him while he's there, this is going to be yours. Put your tent down and just wait. You're where I want you to be. And when things look like it's going to get ugly, he leaves and goes to Egypt. And Egypt is going to be a detrimental trip to the relationship of Abraham and his wife, to Abram's testimony. And even though God still blesses him while he's down there, he is going to show that he has a long, long way to go before he becomes the Abraham that we all know about, this man of faith. It says, and it came to pass, when he was come near to enter into Egypt, that he said unto Sarai his wife, behold now, I know that thou art a fair woman to look upon. Therefore it shall come to pass, when the Egyptians shall see thee, that they shall say, this is his wife, and they will kill me, but they will save thee alive. So I pray thee, thou art my sister, that it may be well with me for thy sake, and my soul shall live because of thee. So Abram has no faith in God. A famine hits, and he goes, oh my goodness, we're going to starve to death and die, and heads to Egypt. And while he's on his way to Egypt, he decides, and it was common in this day and time, I'm not going to take that away from him, that if a man had an attractive wife and another man wanted her, he'd kill the dude and take his wife. That was a pretty common thing back in this time. I'm not going to deny that for Abram. But I'm going to tell you this. If you know that God brought you to this place and a famine starts, but God wants you there, I feel like you're going to have a better chance of staying where God told you to stay than to risk going to a place where you already know there's the possibility someone may kill you for your wife. That's immediate opportunity of death, famine. You can struggle along, and the human body can go through some things there, okay? I mean, I'm sure everybody on that group may have had a few places they could lose a little pounds, okay? You know, we're going to ration some things here. He has so little faith in God that he is willingly going to a place where he already thinks he might get killed because of his wife being a good-looking woman. It makes no logical sense whatsoever that a man who has been promised by God and reassured by God, stay here, I will take care of you, would go to a place where he has more possibility, opportunity to die than to stay where he is. But Abram isn't relying on God to keep him alive. Abram is relying on himself. He tells his wife what? Tell them you're my sister. That way, they aren't going to try to kill me. Again, this happened back a little bit, but it's still also it's an extreme in a lot of ways. Unless Sarai was really as beautiful as the Bible puts out to be, this was kind of a foolish notion on his part to begin with. But this is a man who has been promised by God, don't go anywhere else, stay here, I'll take care of you, that thinks that through his own lying, his own deceit, his own human capabilities, that he cannot have to deal with the famine and also not get killed for his wife by making her his sister. And so he goes to Egypt, tells Sarai what to do. And the moment she gets there, look at what happens. It says, and it came to pass when Abram was coming to Egypt, the Egyptians beheld the woman that she was very fair. So Abram comes in, and Sarai apparently was enough of a looker, she turned every head in Egypt on the way through the door. And it probably also helps, and is not mentioned, that Abram's a very wealthy man. He got a lot of stuff. He's not as wealthy as he's going to be by the end of his life. But he's wealthy enough, it would have grabbed the attention of people as he's coming in. And to add to it, there's this beautiful woman with him as well. And so they take notice of her. And before long, it spreads all around town that there is this good-looking lady that they have no idea where she's from. She's exotic. You know, they're Egyptian. She's Mesopotamian. I'm sure there's a lot of skin color, eye color differences involved in this too. Everybody takes notice of this woman to the point that says the princes also of Pharaoh saw her and commended her before Pharaoh. And the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. word gets around town so much that the nobles, the princes, the sons of Pharaoh come in and they're like, whoa, hey, let me tell you, there's this lady out there you might want to go see if you can't get you, you know, get your bid in on this. She'd be a nice one to have in the harem. And so Pharaoh hears of it, sends for her. She's brought into Pharaoh's house. And he entreated Abram well for her sake. And he had sheep and oxen and he asses and men servants and maid servants and she asses and camels. So Pharaoh goes and he calls them to their house because, see, this is a very short chapter. There's a lot of details that are left out, but I'm going to paint the picture for you of exactly what happens here. Abram comes into Egypt. They immediately grab the attention of the people. This is a semi, you know, a much more than average wealthy man coming with a beautiful woman. People obviously would have come up and introduced themselves to Abram, and especially anybody that had a little bit of wealth or any of the people in the market. People are trying to sell and trying to get the attention of this guy, get a little bit of that money they see coming through the door. And then they're going to ask, oh, well, who is this beautiful woman? Oh, this is my sister. Yeah, I'm his sister. Completely lies. It's a half-truth. Yeah, she's his half-sister, but it's a complete lie. The idea is that they're going to paint the picture that there is no marriage relationship here, that they are a direct family, that she is a single available woman, okay? And this word spreads around town to where the nobles and the princes and the higher-ranking men, they go, wait a minute, time out. No, I'm telling you, man, there's this lady in town. You got to get down there. You boys probably going to want to put in a bid. And why I keep saying put in a bid is because that's exactly what's going to happen here in just a moment, all right? There's a girl down there. She's single. She's kind of with a wealthier, older guy. And I'm sure she'd have a nice dowry to go with her if the looks aren't enough for you. And that gets to Pharaoh's ears, and Pharaoh goes, I haven't recently acquired any women, so I guess we could go take a look. If she's everything y'all say, all of Egypt's roaring about how good looking she is, then, you know, maybe I need to add her to the collection pot back here with the rest of them. And so Pharaoh goes down to Abram. He calls them to his house, meets with Abram. That idea that he entreated him well for her sake is that Pharaoh calls them in and introduces himself, asks them about who they are and where they're from. And Abram says, I'm Abram. We're from here. We've traveled from here. Da, da, da. There's famine. Da, 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 da. And Pharaoh, of course, is going through all these casual pleasantries because he wants to know about who's the good-looking lady behind you. Doesn't really care all that much about what's going on with Abram. He has a goal in mind, and that goal is to get the lady behind him. And so he asks him, I'm filling in the blanks for you. Who's she? Oh, that's my sister. She have a husband. No husband whatsoever, because what's the whole point of this? They don't need to know you're my wife, because if they think you're my wife, they will kill me for you. That's his whole mindset here, okay? So she doesn't have a husband. No husband. That's my sister. She's just traveling with me. And Abram takes the lie all the way to where Pharaoh gives him stuff for his quote-unquote sister. When it says Pharaoh entreated Abram well for her sake, that means Abram essentially traded off Sarai for a whole bunch of stuff. And he got all this stuff as a gift to be able to have her hand in marriage as a wife to Pharaoh. He plays this lie out all the way to the point that he's going to give his own wife to another man to try to save his own neck, when he never should have even been there in the first place. And he goes through with the deal. And Sarai plays along with the lie. She, surprisingly enough, I guess what you would say, fits the role of a good wife. She doesn't even go against her husband. She's willingly going to let herself be put in this sinful situation, this adulterous situation, in her mind to protect her husband. Again, situational ethics. There is no such thing. Right is right and wrong is wrong. And God, looking down on this, I can only imagine what's going through God's head at this particular point. It says in verse 17, look at what God does. It says, and the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. No sooner have they made the deal, and Abram walked away playing out his lie to the point that he doesn't even care if another man knows his wife. God immediately goes, oh, no, 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 no. If this happens, this is going to blow the whole plan. And God intervenes on such a harsh level that Pharaoh called Abraham back and said, what is this that thou hast done unto me? Why didst thou not tell me that she was thy wife? Why saidest thou, she is my sister? So I might have taken her to me to wife. Now therefore, behold thy wife, take her and go thy way. No sooner has this deal taken place, and it could have taken a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, it could have taken even a month or so before word got to Pharaoh about what everything that was going on between Abram and his quote-unquote sister coming into town. Okay, we're not given a disclosed amount of time that takes place here. But we know that the plague was so bad and the things that were brought on them were so terrible and so awful that Pharaoh immediately knew that it was not just because of Sarai, but it was because of Sarai being his wife. Remarkably, even in this day and time, even in this situation, this Gentile king, this idolatrous, immoral king, knew that to take this man's wife as his own was wrong. And he calls back Abram, who's supposed to be the worshiper of the one creator, of the almighty God, of the righteous and holy God, and rebukes him sorely for the evil that he did. Why have you done this to me? Why did you not tell me she was your wife? Why did you say she was your sister? I may have ended up taking her to wife, which means it would have been a whole lot worse than what was already going on. Take your wife and get out of Egypt. Pharaoh is so angry with the deceit and the lies of this man that he doesn't even order him to be executed or any of those things. He could have easily and righteously, really, had Abram killed for the evil and the atrocity that he committed in lying about Sarai being his wife. But he was so appalled and so disgusted by Abram. He just says, get out of Egypt. Get your wife, get your stuff, and get out of Egypt. I don't see your face anymore. To the point it says, and Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away, meaning that he told his men, you make sure they leave. You make sure they don't come back. You make sure that this man and all of that out, get them out of Egypt. This is a lost, idolatrous king that God uses to show Abram, you foolish man. Where is your faith? Where is your strength? Where is your morality? Abram is not that man yet. He's got a long, long way to go in his walk with God. And so when you're looking at this, there's three things we need to take away. Number one, when God is calling you to do something, when God is calling you to fulfill a role, be fully obedient. Him carrying Lot and all that stuff around is part of why he had no faith and was thinking in his flesh and making all of his decisions in his flesh. I am sure that he talked it over with Lot. Lot was like, yeah, that's probably a good idea. You know, I mean, we don't want to die. And I what's the worst that could happen? She gets to live comfortably for a little bit. Then when we're getting ready to leave Egypt, you know, we'll sneak her out, whatever. Okay? Be fully obedient to God. There is a reason God calls you in the way that he does. There's a reason that there's times in the Bible where God says, get away from your family, get away from your country, get away from this, get away from that, because it's going to destroy your walk and what he's wanting to do with your life. Secondly, if you are going to follow the call of God, if you're obedient enough to do what God tells you to do, friend, at least have the faith enough to believe that God is going to keep you where he's already told you to go. There's nothing sadder to me and nothing more ironic than seeing a Christian or a believer, however you want to put it, who is, you can clearly see God has a desire for their life and has something that he wants to do with their life, and they say, yep, I'm going to do it, but then they don't have the faith to stick with it. He gets up and travels all the way from Mesopotamia to an unknown land filled with hostile, violent tribes, gets there, and then doesn't even have the faith to remain there when the road gets a little bit rocky. And was already kind of trying to work his way out of there from the very get-go. And then finally, don't take yourself out of the hand of God and place yourself in a more dangerous situation because you are too scared to believe in what God has told you to do. I have pastor friends that I have seen that were men that God, you could see God put a call on their life, that God was going to use them in a special way, that God called them to a place and they went, things started to get rough, and they jumped the boat literally from the frying pan into the fire, because they were more scared of serving God than they were of having their lives destroyed by something else. Abram was more scared of believing in God and roughing out through the famine and letting God take care of him than he was of potentially putting his own life in harm's way by going into a nation and a country where he believed they might kill him for his wife. Where is the logic in that, friend? I'm here to tell you that fear is what destroys faith. If you have fear in your heart, you don't trust in what God is going to do for you. You are always going to put yourself in a worse situation than the one you think you're in right now. I'm a pastor. There's been times that I've been like, whew, man, I may need to quit this gig. You know, there's no way somebody's got it worse than me. There's no way somebody's dealing with this problem and this problem or this thing or this thing or that thing. Or there's this issue that's going on, or I'm having to deal with this family problem while I'm also trying to take care of a church. These kinds of things, okay? That I have gotten to that point where I was like, well, maybe I'm not supposed to do this anymore. Maybe I'm supposed to back out. Those doubts, those disappointments. That I'd find out a week later, holy cow, so-and-so's got it a whole lot worse than I do. What in the world am I crying about? Guys, do not let fear destroy and take over and placate and run your life. Abram was calmed by God, and his partial obedience put him in a very bad situation. It surrounded him with bad people. Lot's not a very great guy. All of the things of his father's house, that his father and his people were idolatrous. God called him away from all of that so he would be strong enough in his own faith and in looking to God and God's way of doing things so that he could make a great nation out of Abraham. But that partial obedience led to a partial faith, which led to a worse and more illogical decision of going to Egypt than staying in Canaan and trusting God to take care of him through the famine. And it directly resulted in him creating a sin so bad that even an idolatrous king rebukes him and throws him out of the country for lying about Sarai being not being his wife, when in all reality she was indeed his wife. Try with all of your ability as you're going through this week. Obviously, go back and read over this chapter since we've reached the end and we're getting into the wrap-up of it. But go through it this week and literally look at your life and ask yourself, where are you with your faith in God? Are you like Abram, where we ain't got the faith yet? This isn't the Abraham that you've heard of growing up in church where it says, and Abraham was a great man of faith. He is not that guy until the latter half of his life. probably even the latter fourth of his life, more than half, okay? He starts out a man that has absolutely no faith whatsoever. He's partially obedient. In a lot of ways, he's just like you and me. You ask yourself, where are you really at with your faith? When God has asked you to do something, when you know what God's will is in your life, are you being fully obedient to it? Do you have the faith to stay in it? Or are you got such a little faith that you'd rather put yourself in a worse situation than what you think you're going through being obedient to God? That is going to result in the destruction of your own testimony and your own standing before people about who God is and who he is for your in your life. And so, that has been Genesis chapter 12. Again, apologize to a lot of our listeners that came on. I know that last Friday we had a lot of internet trouble, a lot of issues, couldn't get the podcast out, couldn't get the live cast to stick long enough, all these things. But we are going to, that's why we're doing it today. But Friday we will be back at our normal time at 10 a.m. We're going to go through Genesis chapter 13, so we're back on track with where our program was. For any of the new listeners that we have on here today that have joined us this morning, that's glad to have you guys with us. We pray for all of the listeners that we have on here. If you need anything, you have any questions, we have the comment bar on there. You can let me know. Do what we can for you. Try to go back and listen to the ones before. If you're just joining us today, you're kind of coming in on the middle of the boat. We started at going through the whole Bible, doing a survey of the whole Bible and every book of the Bible, giving you the cultural and the historical facts, kind of what the themes and the points are of every book, highlighting the major events, these kinds of things. And now starting with Genesis, going through the rest of the Bible, we're going to be working chapter by chapter, verse by verse, helping to teach you how to study the Word of God on your own. And the questions to ask, the things to look at, the things to consider. As I've told many of our listeners, God writes the things that he wrote the way that he wrote them for a reason. Every word, every phrase, every statement, everything that God is giving you, there's a reason for it. And you gotta learn to ask those questions to gain that deeper understanding, that deeper knowledge of what is really going on here and occurring, and kind of teaching you how to tie all of that back. But so I hope all of you have a great week. I'll see you Friday at 10 a.m. Until then, though, as always, this has been Studies Through the Bible, Pastor Zach Ebarb. You guys get out of here and go study.